Good morning. Today is February 17th, 2017. My name is Vilma Howard, and I will be reading to you today from the Pentagraph. Starting off, workers hold a national strike. The heart of Philadelphia's Italian market was uncommonly quiet. Fine restaurants in New York, San Francisco, and the nation's capital closed for the day. The grocery stores, food trucks, coffee shops, taco joints in places like Chicago, Los Angeles, and Boston shut down. Immigrants around the U.S. stayed home from work and school Thursday to demonstrate how important they are to America's economy and way of life. And many businesses closed in solidarity, and the nationwide protest called the Day Without Immigrants. The boycott was aimed squarely at President Donald Trump's efforts to crack down on immigration, legal and illegal, by such means as a wall at the Mexican border. Organizers said they expected thousands to participate and otherwise show support. The protests even reached into the U.S. Capitol, where a Senate coffee shop was among the eateries that were closed, as employees did not show up for work. The day's activities also included rallies in several cities. Marcella Ardaya, Vargas, who is from Bolivia and now lives in Falls Church, Virginia, pulled her son out of school to take him to a Day Without Immigrants march in Washington. When he asked why he wasn't going to school, I told him because today he was going to learn about immigration. Adding, our job as citizens is to unite our brothers and sisters. Organizers appealed to the immigrants from all walks of life to take part. But the effects were felt most strongly in the restaurant industry, which has long been first to step up in the economic ladder for newcomers to America, with its many jobs for cooks, dishwashers, and servers. Expensive restaurants and fast food joints alike closed across the country. Sushi bars, Brazilian steakhouses, Mexican eateries, and Thai and Italian restaurants turned away lunchtime customers. At a White House news conference held at the same time as lunch hour protest, Trump boasted at his border security measures and immigration arrest of the hundreds of people in the past week, saying, "We are saving lives every single day." Since the end of 2007, the number of foreign-born workers employed in the U.S. has climbed by 3.1 million to 25.9 million. They account for 56% of the increase in the U.S. employment over that period, according to Labor Department. The foreign-born, who included American citizens, green card holders, and those working hard, working without legal authorization, tend to be younger and take jobs in fields that have been growing fast, including restaurants, hotels, and stores. Roughly 12 million people are employed in the restaurant industry, and immigrants make up the majority, up to 70% in places like New York and Chicago, according to the Restaurant Opportunities Center, United, which works to improve working conditions. An estimated 1.3 million in the industry are immigrants living in the U.S. illegally, the group said. In Chicago, Pete's Fresh Market closed 5 to its 12 grocery stores and assured employees they would not be penalized for skipping the day, according to owner Vanessa Drimonis, whose Greek immigrant father started the company. "It's in his DNA to help immigrants," she said. "We've supported immigrants from the beginning." Carmen Solis, a Mexican-born U.S. citizen, took the day off from work as a project manager and brought her 2 children to a rally in Chicago. "I feel like our community is going to be racially profiled and harassed," she said of the Trump immigration policies. It's very upsetting. People like to take our anger on immigrants, but employers are making a profit off of them. The construction industry, which has also employed large numbers of immigrants, was also affected. Shai Frederick, who owns a small construction company in Baltimore, showed up at 7 a.m. at a home he is renovating and was surprised to find that he was alone, with a load of drywall ready to install. He soon understood why. His crew, five immigrants, called, said they were coming in and were not coming into work. They were joining the protest. And now in other news, Lynch embraced the detours. In Normal, a self-described C-minus student who went on to become an award-winning actress told those attending the Illinois State University Founders Day convocation to embrace the detours in their lives. In fact, Jane Lynch told those gathered Thursday at the Bone Student Center not to have goals because rigid goals can lead you to overlook opportunities. Lynch said she was a girl who would have to have a plan and a woman of list. When she came to ISU in 1978, the Emmy and Golden Globe award-winning actress who starred as a cheerleading coach, Sue Sylvester, in the Fox musical comedy Glee, was always interested in acting, but didn't plan to major in theater when she came to ISU. "My mother told me, theater is not a career," she said, after receiving an honorary doctorate of arts in recognition of her achievements since graduating in 1982. But the mass communications classes her mother told her to take were full and wound up in fewer theater classes, prompting her to change her major without telling her parents. "My passion began to blossom," she said, noting her grades also began to go up. "I found my own unique intelligence, something you can't tell from an ACT score," Lynch said. "I'm thankful for all the mishaps and the detours that led her to where she is today, a host of the Hollywood Game Night, with numerous films, television, and stage credits." "Don't be a humorless do-gooder," Lynch advised. "Do operate from your heart. Become a light beacon for anyone lucky enough to be in your presence." President Larry Dietz described Lynch as a rock star in her own right and said he was pretty sure this is the first honorary degree we've awarded to a cheerleading coach from another school, a reference to her role in Glee. The convocation, where numerous faculty, staff, and students were recognized with awards, was part of the Founders Day celebration. Activities included the traditional bell ringing ceremony in the Student Center using the replica of the old main bell as ISU marked the school's birthday with one ring with each of the 160 years. At that earlier ceremony, Deeds said that despite recent challenges, including the lack of a state budget, the ISU community can take pride in the fact that ISU has, for the most part, pertained our own destiny. "Illinois State University continues to thrive," said Dietz. "We've succeeded by putting our students first." Throughout the day, people on campus could hear echoes of the original old man bell being rung on the quad by anyone who passed by and wanted to take part in the bell ringing tradition. Among those honored at the afternoon convocation were history professor Alan Lesoff, who was named a university professor among ISU's highest honors, and biology professor Rachel Bowden and marketing professor Stephen Taylor, who were named distinguished professors. To be named a distinguished professor, a professor must have achieved national recognition and identified as an outstanding teacher or have contributed significant public service in his or her academic discipline. In other news, President Donald Trump's administration said in a court documents Thursday it wants to end the legal fight over its ban on travelers from seven predominantly Muslim nations and will issue a replacement ban as it strives to protect the nation. Details of the new proposal were not provided in a filing or at wide-ranging news conference by Trump, but lawyers for the administration said in the filing that a ban that focuses solely on foreigners who has never entered the U.S. instead of green card holders already in the U.S. who have traveled abroad and want to return would pose no legal different or difficulties. In doing so, the president will clear the way for immediately protecting the country rather than pursuing further potentially time-consuming litigation, the filing said. Trump said at the news conference that he and the new order would come next week. "I will not back down from defending our country. I got elected on our defense of our country," he said. The administration asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to hold off on making any more decisions related to the lawsuit filed by the state of Washington and Minnesota until the new order is kissed, and then tossed out the decision keeping the ban on hold. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson said the federal government was conceding defeat by saying it does not want a larger appellate panel to review the decision made last week by a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court. The judges rejected the Trump administration's claim of presidential authority and questioned his motives in ordering the ban. The administration attacked the decision in Thursday's court filings, saying the panel wrongly suggested some foreigners were entitled to constitutional protection and that the courts could consider Trump's campaign statements about the ban. The lawsuit says the ban unconstitutionally blocked entry to the U.S. on a basis of religion and harmed residents, universities, and sales tax revenue in the two states. 18 other states, including California and New York, supported the challenge. The appeals court had asked the Trump administration in Washington and Minnesota to file arguments by Thursday on whether a later, larger panel of the Ninth Circuit judge should rehear the case. In other news, Crawford looking to end Illinois career on the D-line. Champaign, Dwayne Smoot, Carroll Phillips, and Chunky Clements will soon be going to the NFL scouting combine in Indianapolis last fall. They all played on the defensive line for the University of Illinois. Smoot and Phillips were defensive ends, as was Gemmell President, a transfer from Auburn. Each of those players has graduated, making a restocking of that position a priority for Coach Lovie Smith and his staff. On the first day of spring practice this week, a player recruited by the former head coach Tim Beckman emerged as a person to watch. It only took James Crawford 5 years and several position changes to evolve into this latest role. One of the few seniors on the roster, Crawford was recruited in 2012, signed in February 2013, and arrived hoping to fill Beckman's star position in a hybrid safety linebacker. He has also played in secondary as at the linebacker and late last season got a look at defensive end. Crawford has physically grown into his new role and believes he is mentally prepared too, mainly because he has played virtually everywhere on the defensive side without ever getting discouraged. "It's something different, but I think I'm able to do it," Crawford said this week, flashing his trademark smile. "Defensive end is a lot easier, to be honest. There's not as much thinking. You have minimal responsibilities, and I get to go after the quarterback every time, and that sounds like fun to me." Defensive coordinator Hardy Nickerson said Crawford has great burst off the ball and great lean. "I kid him because when we had met him at defensive end last year, and in one game he missed two sacks," Nickerson said. "He just got back there too fast and wasn't used to being on top of the quarterback and ran right past him." Crawford said he weighed 215 pounds a year ago, thinking he would be playing safety. Now he weighs 235 pounds. And although that may sound light for a defensive end, Nickerson said Crawford can still be effective against the run. And moving on to some other news, as Snapchat prepares for an IPO, Snapchat Incorporated set a starting price range of $14 to $16 per share for its initial public offering, which at the top end could value Los Angeles technology company at more than $22 billion. The IPO of Snapchat Mobile app developer is expected to be the largest ever for a Los Angeles firm and the biggest since Alibaba and Facebook. The share prices were disclosed in securities filing early Thursday, are non-binding. They set the stage for Snap officials, led by Chief Executive Evan Spiegel and the investment bankers at Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, to hold discussions with investors around the world about their interest in betting on a nearly 6-year-old company. Scheduled gatherings included an event in London next Monday and New York and the day after. The company started as a self-destructing photo messaging app, but has added features for texting, video sharing, money transfers, and news to become the leading entertainment hub for 158 million daily users, most of them young adults. Snap hopes to raise about $2.3 billion in cash from selling shares, which it would spend on hiring, taxes, technology, acquisitions, marketing, and other efforts in the coming years. Snap poached top Instagram executives in 2014, but it ended in an expensive resignation. Existing shareholders, a group that includes Spiegel and co-founder Bobby Murphy, plan to sell holdings worth another $880 million. Other selling owners included Chairman and early investor Michael Linton and venture capital firm Benchmark, Lightspeed Venture Partners, General Catalyst, and SV Angel. And if the initial batch sells out, the company could offer another $246 million net worth of shares and existing owners another $235 million for a total sale of $3.7 billion for 230 million shares. Snap would have about 1.4 billion shares outstanding on a fully diluted basis. But the size of the windfall depends on the final price per share. That's unlikely to be determined until earlier than March 1st. And now we take a break and get on to the obituaries, starting off with the passing of Beverly Neubauer of Bloomington. Beverly was 91, lived in Bloomington, and passed away at 6:25 p.m. on Sunday. Russell Miller. Russell was 62 of February, died at 6:50 p.m. on Tuesday at the OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Bloomington. In Gibson City, Joan Marie Cook Cothran, 77, formerly of Leroy, passed away at 8:41 a.m. Tuesday at the Gibson City Area Hospital in Gibson City. Ty Than Nguyen, 47, of Bloomington, died at 11:06 on Wednesday at his home. And funerals for today: David Duff, Clean Andrew, Minor Lyle, Thomas Inez. And now moving to some other news, McDonald's updates their menu in Chicago. Old favorites are getting a new life under the golden arches. Last month, McDonald's rolled out two new sizes of the Big Macs, the Grand Mac and the Mac Junior. And a few weeks ago, it added to its annual Shamrock Shake offer with four new mint flavor drinks. Other riffs on the menu staples are being offered in regions around the country, including the Sriracha Big Mac, garlic fries, and chicken McGriddles. The strategy behind the introduction is a smart one if it works. Observers say it allows the world's largest burger chain to entice new customers and convince the old ones to buy in more, while keeping costs low, limiting complications in the kitchen. If you look at our past, we were probably too focused on leaning on new products, said Lance Richards, McDonald's Vice President of Menu Strategy. Now we are celebrating the menu items that are unique to McDonald's, and we think that They are a huge opportunity to do more of that across the menu. Since CEO Steve Easterbrook took the helm almost 2 years ago, the company has focused on improving quality rather than the quantity of its menu items. But bringing more customers in the door has been a challenge. McDonald's needs to entice more customers without giving out a limb to create a flashy new menu item that may not sell, said the restaurant consultant Dan McGowan. A great hostess walks a step to a step and a half in front of the guest. If they get 3 or 4 steps ahead, you'll have people standing around in the middle of the restaurant looking around saying, "Where'd you go?" McGowan said. It's the same thing with the menu. If you are 3 or 4 steps ahead, you might lose them. Adding too many new items can also bog the kitchen down while workers get used to constructing new sandwiches or using new ingredients. You don't want to give employees a whole new binder on how to assemble a sandwich, McGowan said. They know how to make a Big Mac. Timing is especially important at quick service restaurants like McDonald's, which aims to deliver in less than 2 minutes and get most of their business from the drive-through window. And now the next article, how to tell if young kids need glasses. If toddlers are too young to identify letters, pictures on an eye chart, how will parents know if they need glasses? Routine checkups at a pediatrician's office frequently includes a vision screening procedure that takes a photograph of the child's eye. Analysis of the results can give the doctor useful information about whether the child needs to wear glasses, says Dr. Stephen Rubin, co-chief of the pediatric ophthalmology at the Northwell Health. Between screenings, Rubin offers this advice: whether a toddler gets right up close to the television isn't always a reliable gauge in itself of the child's eyesight, Rubin said. Toddlers tend to get close to the TV so that it takes up most of their field of vision, and to avoid peripheral distractions, he says. What's more telling is whether after mom and dad pulls the child back, the toddler keeps walking to the screen. Likewise, most toddlers also like to hold books close to their faces, even if they aren't extremely nearsighted. So that isn't a surefire measure of either. What Ruben recommends looking at is frequent squinting. When the child squints, he is looking through a narrower opening and can see more clearly. If parents suspect a problem, Ruben recommends toddlers be taken to a pediatrician who has medical training and will always dilate the child's pupils to rule out any eye diseases that can cause reduced vision. The doctor can then use an instrument called a retinoscope to examine the child's eye and determine the prescription needed. Rubin says a child doesn't need a verbal in order to get a prescription, he says. And into another article, politics at the Oscars. Meryl Streep ushered politics into Hollywood's awards season when she used her Golden Globe acceptance speech to condemn President Donald Trump for what she called his instinct to humiliate. Stars were even more outspoken at the Screen Actors Guild Awards, held just days after Trump's travel ban caused havoc across the airports across the country. Even last week's performance-heavy Grammy Awards had a political edge when members of the A Tribe Called Quest raised their fist and the Q-Tip repeated a call to resist. The February 26th Academy Awards, our final stop of the industry's annual 2 months of self-adulation. While some producers aren't planning any political content, the night's winners might be. As much as first-time Oscar telecast producers Michael DeLuca and Jennifer Todd may want their own show to focus on the magic of the movies, they say they support any messages spoken from the heart, even if it means turning the Oscar podium into a political pulpit. The show has to stand behind the free exchange of ideas, DeLuca said in a recent interview. I do believe a little bit in the famous Sam Goodwin wrote about movies: if you want to send a message, call Western Union. There's always a school of thought that says people are turning in to celebrate the storytelling that's moved them, and should we limit what you say to a celebration of that? But Oscar-caliber artists are the kind of people that do get moved by the environment and the world they live in, De Luca said. They want to use their moment on the stage to share those feelings the same way you share the story that you're being nominated for. We want to honor that too. Given the tone set by celebrities at other award shows this season, on the social media since the election, some anti-Trump rhetoric at the Oscars wouldn't be surprising. The show already has a political element. The Iran director and star of foreign language film nominee, The Salesman, have said they will not attend the ceremony in protest of Trump's travel ban. Film Academy President Cheryl Bone Isaac was clear at the annual nominee luncheon last week that the organization support artists and freedom of expression. Each and every one of us knows that there are some empty chairs in this room, which has made the Academy artist activists, she said. There's a struggle globally today over artistic freedom that feels more urgent than at any other time since the 1950s. Oscar host Jimmy Kimmel hasn't given much hint of his approach to the new show. Winners are free to use their allotted 45 seconds of speaking as they please. I hope that the Oscar speeches, whatever they are just well said. Are just well, said co-producer Todd. I love them when Patricia Arquette talked about fair pay when accepting the supporting actress role in 2015. She did a beautiful job and she spoke for her heart. So I think that as long as you're going to do it well. Passionate expression also make for compelling television, DeLuca added. Those feelings can create a moment for the telecast that are really memorable, he said, and spontaneousness is our friend. Anything that's not scripted, that's natural and from the heart, it is a good thing for the telecast. And if viewers who disagree with the politics decide to turn it out, we're a mind of people, let people be. And they will not worry about the public reaction, DeLuca said. Oscar nominees and guests say they expect politics to have a presence at the 89th Academy Awards. I suppose each Oscar show represents its time on the level, said Viggo Mortensen, nominated for lead actor for the Captain Fantastic. I think the Trump White House so far is not about being, let's say, completely honest and above board. It's not really about intellectual curiosity. It's not about listening to people who think differently. It's about to some degree, shutting people up who don't like or who don't agree with you. And I think the Oscars will probably be the opposite of that. All right, and that concludes our reading for the day. Today was February 17th, 2017. It is a beautiful Friday. My name is Vilma Howard. I hope you all have a blessed, wonderful, warm day. Thank you for listening. Bye now.